Good morning. Rabbi Kalman's given me the privilege of introducing our next speaker, Rabbi Dr. Adam Furziger. Dr. Adam Furziger is the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Fellow in Jewish Studies at Bar-Ilan University, where he teaches and serves as Associate Director in the Graduate Program in Contemporary Jewry. He has lectured and published extensively on Jewish religious denominations and their ideologies, modern Jewish history formation, the history of the modern rabbinate, American Orthodoxy, and the encounter between halacha and contemporary social realities. His first book, Exclusion and Hierarchy, Orthodoxy, Non-Observance, and the Emergence of Modern Jewish Identity, this is the book, was published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in June 2005. Together with Professor Avi Ravitsky and Professor Yosef Salmon, he is the editor of Orthodox Judaism New Perspectives. In his capacity as a senior research fellow at Bar-Ilan's Rappaport Center for Assimilation Research, he has authored major studies on the role of rabbis in confronting assimilation and on the community kollel as a cutting-edge framework in American Jewish life. He received his BA, MA, and rabbinical ordination from Yeshiva University and his PhD summa cum laude from Bar-Ilan. He and his wife, Naomi, moved to Israel in 1987. They live with their six children in Kfar Saba, where they are involved in activities aimed at providing religious and educational services to Jews from a broad spectrum of backgrounds. He will be speaking today on Brother or Other, Orthodoxy, and the Non-Observant Jew.
Does this work? Is it projected? Maybe I'll do it a little higher. That okay? No? Okay. First of all, I want to thank my friend and not quite relative, but we're connected by marriage, to Michael Lacks, who's been kind enough to host me while I'm here, and for that very, very kind introduction. And I also want to thank Rabbi and Mrs. Kalman, Dr. and Mrs. Malamet, for organizing this wonderful conference. And I have to say, coming from Israel and being somebody who grew up in New York, and I do speak a lot around the greater North America, each time I encounter a new community, but I had no idea what to expect when I was invited to Toronto. I looked a little on the internet to, you know, find out a little bit about the community. I spoke to some people, but I am really, really impressed. And I think it's wonderful that people come out on a Motzei Shabbat, on a Sunday, to learn Torah, to expand, to think. And I hope I'll be able to contribute a little bit to that experience. If I see that this sort of Madonna setup starts to get a little cumbersome, I may go to the regular microphone. One more thing, really on a solemn note. Michael Lacks mentioned that, I actually have it here, we just published a new book in Hebrew, which is called Ha-Orthodoxia Yehudit Hebetim Chadashim, Orthodox Judaism, New Perspectives. It's published by the Hebrew University Magnus Press. And it's really the first book that's come out in the Hebrew language devoted exclusively to studies on different aspects of orthodoxy from an academic perspective. But the reason I'm mentioning it at this point is because one of my co-editors is Professor Avi Ravitsky, who is a wonderful, wonderful person, a wonderful scholar, who's very dedicated not only to academia, but to people and to public health, and to his vision of Klal Yisrael. And as many of you know, unfortunately, he was hit in a freak accident by a bus 3 weeks ago, walking on the streets of Yerushalayim, and he's still in a coma. And it's very, 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 it's a terrible tragedy. So I'm not asking everyone for, you know, any sort of collective tefillah at this point, but if everyone at some point can dedicate a tefillah to him, Be'ezrat Hashem, maybe there will be some Yeshua, some Nisim v'Niflaot. I want to start with a joke. It's a bad joke, and I'm telling it to you because I think most people know it. Everyone knows about the Jewish Robinson Crusoe, who was unfortunately stuck on that desert island. Good. Okay. And after 25 years, finally they came to save him. And they looked and they saw, I guess we should call him Reuben Crusoe, it's probably more appropriate. And they saw that he had, in the course of those 30 years, he had succeeded in building 3 different buildings, right? Of course. So they said to him, Reuben, what are these beautiful binyanim that you have managed to construct? And he said, over there, that's my bayit, that's my home. Very proud of my home. And over there, well, that's my shul, that's my synagogue. Go there regularly to pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that one, well, that's the other shul. I would never step foot in that shul. This is typical self-deprecating, tragic Jewish humor. And we tell it, and we sort of like to browbeat ourselves. I don't know, you know, we like to make ourselves feel bad. Unfortunately, humor often rings true. It's sort of like my brother-in-law, Cliff, that some of you know, he likes to say, how do we know that Chazal had a sense of humor? Because they said, Talmidei Chachamim Marbim Shalom Ba'olam. But despite that, there is something very important that we can learn from this little joke, the Robinson Crusoe one, that stems from the study of sociology. And I want to point out, for those who were at Professor Heilman's wonderful lecture just now, there is, I wouldn't say overlap, but there's a conversation that will definitely go on between that lecture and my lecture. In a sense, chronologically, I suppose my lecture should have come first, or maybe we could say that my lecture addresses some of the roots of some of the concepts that Professor Heilman expanded upon and deepened our knowledge about regarding orthodoxy in contemporary society. So we'll be looking back a little bit. Anyway, getting to this little joke, when Reuven built that third shul, why did he build it? So I think that Emile Durkheim, the great French Jewish sociologist of the early 20th century, might say that he built the third shul, the second shul, the third building, second shul, in order to define himself. This is what's known as the sociology of deviance. It's very hard to say, who am I? What am I? Self-definition is something that we spend our lives trying to approach, but it's really a hard thing to do. What we end up doing so often, and it seems to be a natural human condition, is that we spend our time defining ourselves through who we are not. Good. So I think that Reuven Crusoe is sitting there on that island saying, who am I? Ma ani, mechayai, mechazai, maishuatai. You know, like we say on Yom Kippur, but he's got lots of time on his hands, and he says, you know, well, maybe, so to speak, through the other, I can figure out who I am. Kai Erickson, who was a wonderful sociologist and criminologist of the 1960s, he wrote a lovely book about, not about Jews, he wrote about Puritans, about 17th century Puritan society in New England. We're getting close to American Thanksgiving. For those of you who are American natives, United States natives, so that may resonate for you. And he noticed that in the course of about 100 years, there were three different episodes in which the Puritans worked very hard to focus on a particular group and to outcast them, to define them as being the other, ha'acher. And he looked at each of those episodes, what he called moral panics or boundary crises, and he tried to learn about more general human relations from the specific historical case study. And what he noticed was that generally what happened was that at certain points, what he would call liminal points, at points where the Puritans felt threatened, where they felt that their society was under attack, that maybe consciously, maybe subconsciously, they would sort of find a new group and call that the other. The one, the most famous one, of course, is the Salem witch craze, which is part of that. You know, Arthur Miller wrote The Crucible. We're familiar with his using that as a parable to the communist McCarthyism craze in the 1950s in the United States. But back there with the Puritans, they were worried about maintaining some sense of collectivity. And once it was the Quakers, once it was the witches, once it was another group, and in an interval of about 20, 30 years, each time they were basically defining who they were, trying to focus on their own self-identity by, again, defining the other. He also noticed, of course, that these things weren't necessarily consistent, that something which at one point would be acceptable as the society felt a greater need to streamline itself, well, the new definitions of deviance, new definitions of being outside the margin would emerge. So if witchcraft or witchery might have been the line at one point, Quakerism, which is sort of a little bit of a different theology, becomes the boundary later on as the group feels more threatened or it feels the necessity of streamlining itself in a more precise manner. Let's just look for a second at the first quote on the source sheets. Just I think that he speaks very well about what he tried to generalize from the specific case. He says, the deviant is a person whose activities have moved outside the margins of the group, and when the community calls him to account for that vagrancy, it is making a statement about the nature and placement of its boundaries. It is declaring how much variability and diversity can be tolerated within the group before it begins to lose its distinctive shape, its own unique identity. So I think that says it very nicely. And I think that there is a thoughtful idea here that we can then look at and use as a tool for looking at other situations. In my case, I wrote this book, Exclusion and Hierarchy, in which I began with Erickson, basically, as a point of departure to look at something that had existentially concerned me, partially because of growing up in an Orthodox home, but I grew up in Riverdale, New York, in a sort of a pluralistic type of environment, partially because I moved to Israel and the issues of secular and religious were so intense. For whatever reason, I think most scholars, not all, but certainly Jewish studies scholars, who choose a subject, hopefully they adopt the tools of science and critical method, but usually we resonate to the issues and that's what brings us to talk about those things. So that's what sort of brought me to the topic. But I wanted to, again, be able to look at this. I don't even like the word objectivity because I think nobody's ultimately objective, but at least to use recognizable tools that others could then judge me, you know, and see if I have integrity in the way that I'm looking at these issues. And I wanted to apply Erickson and other people to the question of, you know, what is the nature of the relationship historically between Orthodoxy and Orthodox Jews and non-observant Jews? And essentially, I wasn't ultimately interested in defining the modern Jew, the secular, non-observant, non-Orthodox Jew. I had to deal with that. But I was really interested in looking at how people who presented themselves as Orthodox leaders, how those people defined the non-Orthodox, because I thought that that would be a very intuitive way to achieve a better understanding of what Orthodoxy is, or what is the historical development that has taken place in Orthodoxy over a few hundred years. So that's where we're at, and that is essentially it encapsulates what I want to do a little bit of with you today. A little bit of historical background, and it's just sort of general. So please excuse me if I miss the nuances. But essentially, and we're going to be focusing at this point on European Jewry. If we look at Ashkenazi Central European Jewry, we're not talking about Eastern Europe. We're not talking about the Shtetlach of Eastern Poland, Russia, etc. Talk about places like Germany, places like France, parts of England. England's a little bit of a different story. Austro-Hungary, so to speak, except for Galicia. The big change starts to take place in the 18th century. In the 1700s, what was once known, as my teacher Jacob Katz said, as the traditional society begins to disintegrate. The traditional society is a society of what Charles Lieben called taken for grantedness. A society in which you were born into a certain family and into a certain community. You didn't have a lot of choices. Communal structure was a Jewish autonomy. If people think that the state of Israel is the first time that we have self-rule, well, yes and no. It's the first time we have sovereignty, but throughout the pre-modern world, beyond our relationships with the non-Jewish structure, whether it be the nobles, the kings, etc., or whoever ruled that place, basically Jews were given permission to rule themselves. Taxes were collected as a group and then handed over. When it came to issues of relations between Jews, whether it be civil relations or issues of ben adam lamakom, the Jew vis-a-vis his God and his halachic obligations, there was a system of religious coercion, a system of punishments that was adopted by most communities in order to ensure that people stayed in. Now, most people didn't want to go out because that's all they knew, and that's what a Jew was. A Jew was a person who was observant, who kept Shabbat, who kept Kashrut, kept Tarat HaMishpacha, went to synagogue, etc., etc. There always were Yotzei Dofen. To think that every single Jew was the same, that's absurd. But I think what's important is to recognize that those people who were small in number, who did deviate from the norm, were just that. They were deviants. They were people who were on the margin. And by being on the margin, they defined what was normative. What was normative was keeping the halacha, etc. And those people who didn't want to keep the halacha were threatened with punishment, whether it be a fine, whether it be not getting aliyah in shul, whether it be nidui cherem, etc. I don't know how many times they really had to totally excommunicate people, but it was really effective. The threat of it was really effective. Why was it effective? Because there was no what we would call neutral society. What do you do if you get excommunicated by your kehila? Well, you can't become a secular Jew. You can't become an unaffiliated Jew. You can't become a conservative reform, Zionist, cultural, bagel-eating, Bundist, whatever it is. Those are modern ideas. You basically have to become an apostate. Convert to Christianity, convert to Islam in a Muslim country. Most Jews, even if they weren't totally at peace with rabbinic authority or with the communal structure, well, they certainly preferred being Jewish to anything else. Some people think that's absurd. Why would you want to be this, downtrodden minority? But most Jews wanted to stay Jewish. The modern condition is what I have referred to as the normativization of deviance. that which was once the Yotzeh Min HaKlal becomes the Klal. And in fact, if you look just for a second at the last source here, Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman, who was a very important rabbinical authority and biblical scholar in Germany, in Berlin, in the late 19th and early 20th century, he says, at the end of the back page, he says, he describes the difference between his day, in which by then maybe 15-20% of the Jews of Germany were observant. We're talking about, let's say, 1910. He says the following. He says, however, it's six lines from the bottom. However, in the middle, due to our many sins, most of them have burst through the fence. Their repair stems from their degeneration. Each individual believes that Sabbath desecration is not a serious transgression, that there is no need to do it privately. Thus, this is the important part. His public farhesia performance is, as it were, in private, but see not. Quite the contrary. The God-fearing in our times are the ones who are called separate and distinct, while the sinners are the ones who follow the ways of the land. So who has become the deviant? The Orthodox, right? Those who were once the majority, the dominant, they are the deviant, says Rav David Zvi Hoffman about himself. So he's there giving a big heter because he's saying there is no longer a public in which to talk about Michalel Shabbat for Farhesia, to talk about a public Sabbath desecrator, because the concept of public has completely does not exist in the way that it existed in pre-modern times. But we're jumping ahead a little bit. Take a little drink. So this process of moving from a traditional homogeneous society to a heterogeneous, complex, diverse society of choice is something which begins in places like Germany in the 18th century and moves along in more and more intensively. Just to give a statistic, by the year 1850, 156 years ago, more than 50% of the Jews of Germany did not keep Shabbos. Now, for rabbinic authorities and for Jews who remained committed to observance and to Jewish halachic tradition, this caused tremendous difficulties on social levels, on personal levels, on family levels, things that today are part of our normal life as complex modern Jews. Well, what interested me is, you know, what did people do at the beginning? How did they go along with these things? How did they deal with them? Now, one of the big problems was that we have, as people who are committed to Jewish tradition, we have halakha. We have codes of laws. And our codes of laws say a lot of things. They tell us what we can eat and what we can't eat. They actually also tell us who we can eat with and who we can't eat with, whose food we can eat, whose food we can't eat. So the Gemara in Chulin, Hey Amud Aleph, says, Mechalel Shabbat b'Farhesia kigoy l'chol davar. A public Sabbath desecrator is like a Gentile, it's like a Gentile in every way. And we have other parallel sources. When we look in the medieval codes, you look in Rambam, the great man of the Shvil HaZahav of the Middle Road, you know, he says clearly that there are certain types of sinners that if they fall into a pit, you don't pick them up and you let them die. How often that happened, that's, you know, codes and practical law is another question. But what I'm pointing out to you is that you have a halachic tradition, a text tradition, which is particularly challenging to a pluralistic modern society. Let's be a little bit simpler and get into something that we're going to deal with here. The Beit Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, who's the author of the Shulchan Aruch, brings down a halacha that some of you may know, which says that we all know from the Gemara in Avodah Zarah that you're not allowed to drink yayin nesach, which is wine of libation, which has been prepared for use in a idolatrous setting. We know that the Gemara in Avodah Zarah expanded that idea to apply to what's called stam yinam, to any wine which was produced by a Gentile, whether it be because of their fear that people would be then sort of moving, wouldn't distinguish between the types of wines, or whether it was what's called mishum chatnut, because they were concerned about intermarriage, you know, way back then. But what we see in Rabbeinu, in the Beit Yosef brought down in the name of Rabbeinu Yonah, is that he says that not only that, but you can't drink wine which was touched by a mechalel Shabbat b'farhesia. Now, if I were a medievalist, which I'm not, though I did do a lot of my master's work with people who are like Jacob Katz and his early studies or parts of his studies or David Berger or Benji Campbell, I might look and say, you know what? When they wrote that halacha, I could historicize it. I could say, you know, they were talking about Mechalel Shabbat Peresia, somebody who's about to become a Christian apostate. So what they were just really trying to do is to keep you away from those people who had really deviated. But they didn't mean like a contemporary sort of economically motivated non-observant Jew or somebody who just socially, normatively become, you know, it could be that that's the case. But one of the things that I try to do is not to read sources in the way that people might have read them in the 13th century, because I don't know if I'm equipped, if I have enough manuscript skills, if that, you know, that's not what I'm trained in. But I think that I have enough training to understand how Orthodox Jews or modern Jews look at sources. And when a modern Jew sees a halacha in the Rambam or in the Shulchan Aruch, well, he takes that very seriously. So maybe in Professor Heilman's contrapunctal system, well, they just sort of say, well, regarding kashrus, I can be glatt, but regarding other Jews, I won't be so glatt. And they sort of make those sort of distinctions, and we live in this differentiated world. But I think that at least on some level, if it's written in the halakha, well, you can't just ignore it. And that's, in fact, what happens, is that rabbinic authorities felt that they couldn't ignore it. I'm so afraid I'm going to trip. So far, you know, I'm not such a good dancer for them. I'm trying here. Anyway, so they looked at these halachot and they said, you know, they asked a question which is sort of a really challenging question, which a lot of us sometimes ask quietly, but we're sometimes afraid to ask it out loud. But in fact, some of our great Rabbanim and Poskim asked it out loud. They said, does this still apply? Do those halachas that were from the Gemara or from the Mishnah Torah or the Shulchan Aruch written in a very different historical circumstance, do they still apply? Well, Reform and conservative scholars or rabbis or authorities generally are much more willing to talk about halachic change in a de jure way, in a way in which things are, you know, if it doesn't apply, then we change, we go with ruach halacha, or we say, like Reform Jews do, that halacha is something which is not obligatory, and then we choose to based on the spiritual enhancement of that particular halacha, which hasn't stopped, by the way, just as a caveat, of Reform Judaism from becoming much more interested in halacha in the last 10, 15 years, because they have come to the conclusion that it may not be obligatory, but halacha somehow is very helpful to maintaining a committed, engaged Jewish life. That's just on the side. But those people were committed to the halachic system, essentially using the principles of generations. Well, they wouldn't say, you know, it doesn't apply anymore. But they had to deal. And some people said it applies completely. And some people said that, well, said some interesting things. And I'll get to what I think they said in a few moments. But let's look at the two sides. So, again, in a lecture, I can't provide the multitude of sources that are that exist, and I hope that people who are really interested in the subject will study further. Idach Zil Gmur. But just to represent two models, I think a wonderful model and a very authoritative model for one way of dealing with the rise of the modern non-observant Jew, the modern public Sabbath desecrator, or in this case, someone who actually is ideologically opposed to the halachic system, is the Chatam Sofer of Moshe Sofer, who was arguably the most authoritative posek of the last 200 years. He was born in 1762 in Frankfurt am Main. He moved as a young man to Hungary. He made his great name for himself from 1806 till his death in 1839 as the Rav of Pressburg, today Bratislava, the capital of Slovakia. So he was asked actually about Reform Jews. And if we had time, we'd get into the details of the difference between Reform Jews, Sabbath desecrators, stuff like that. And there are certainly issues that we could discuss there. But just look at the general outlook that he puts forward here. And we're looking at number two. And of course, I provided the rabbinic language sources, the Militza Hebrew sources, but I'm going to read in English. If we had the power over them, my opinion would be to separate them from us. We should not give our daughters to their sons, and their sons should not be accepted for our daughters, so as not to be drawn after them. No intermarriage whatsoever with Jews who are connected to Reform. Their sect should be considered like those of Tzadok, the Tzdukim, and Baitos, the Baitusim, from the Second Temple period. Like Anan, who's Anan, the founder of the Karaites. Anan ben David, and Saul, Paul of Tarsus, the founder of Christianity as an independent religion. They among themselves, and we among ourselves. And then he adds, rejoinder, all this appears correct according to the law, but not in practice, for without the permission of the king, my words have no authority. So he recognized that in a modern world where the kihilah has lost its autonomy and its ability to coerce, he really wasn't sure if he would really be able to do this. His students in a later generation thought that they had regained some of that control and actually tried to institute these things in practice. Not all his students, but some of his students, what Michael Silber has referred to as the Hungarian ultra-Orthodox. But in terms of a Weltanschauung, in terms of a worldview, we certainly have a position being staked here. Them and us. This is what I would refer to as outcasting. This is a very, very precise, or I would say expansive version of what our Reuven Crusoe did, right? He has seen the other, he has defined the other, and he has said that other is beyond the margin, is beyond the boundary, is beyond the norm, and therefore I will create, halachically, artificially, however we describe it, I will create a boundary, a border, a margin to make it clear who we are and who we are not. Can't marry them. Intermarriage. That is the classic Jewish boundary. And here that boundary is being used, Jew versus Jew. Now let's look at another position which is taken. Taken by not quite as famous a person, but also a very, very major authority. His name was Rabbi Jacob Ettlinger. He lived in Germany. He became famous as the Rabbi of Altona in northwestern Germany near the border with Denmark. He was the last Av Beit Din of a religious court in Germany during the modern period. He died in 1871. He's known, for those who study Talmud, as the Aruch Laner. In his Shelot V'Tshuvot, his Responsa collection, Binyan Tzion HaChadashot, which was published after his death by his son, Ben Tzion Ettlinger, he addresses the question of drinking the wine of a Mechalel Shabbat Parhesia, drinking the wine of a Jew who is a public Sabbath desecrator. And by the way, just a little bit of a thing, you know, when you study history, some of the things that come up, just for a second. When I studied this particular source, it wasn't new to me. This is sort of considered the classic tshuva on the public Sabbath, the modern public Sabbath desecrator. Like, if you ask people who are in the learning world, what's the lenient tshuva that you know? Oh, they'll say Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, Tinok Shenishma. But, you know, when you look at things more closely and you carefully, in a historical sense, and you read them using certain tools, I think sometimes you discover things that, even if it's a well-known source, are not so familiar. One of the things is just a simple thing. When you open the book, it says at the beginning of this tshuva, it says, tshuvot lahalacha v'lo lamaaseh. It says that these are theoretical responsa, that these do not have practical application. So, you know, that's a pretty strong statement, and you think, well, there may be some sort of, it's like giving a shir, you know? It's like a iyun, but no one would be posek based on a Reb Chaim on, you know, in a Gemara in Baba Batra, or on a Rambam. Psak is psak. Adjudication is adjudication. And theoretical learning is theoretical learning. But then I everyone mentions this. All the people who are against this tshuva mention, isn't it great that he made sure no one can learn anything from this? So the first thing is, in law, it doesn't work that way. As soon as you set down a legal principle, you may not apply it all the way, but anyone else, it's open field. And that's what happens. Everyone quotes this all the time. But historically, I just want to point out is that if you start reading actually his son's manuscript and his introduction to the tshuvot that he collected, he says clearly that what happened was this tshuva was actually written to someone named Shmaryahu Zuckerman, who was Ben-Zion Ettlinger's father-in-law. And apparently Ben-Zion Ettlinger came across this tshuva after his father had died, and probably his father-in-law, who was a very accomplished person in Belarusia, had these letters between him and his mechutan. And his father-in-law was actually a very conservative, with a small c, Orthodox Jew, and he had asked, well, what about these, what do you think, Rabbi Ettlinger, can you drink the wine? And Ben-Zion Ettlinger, not Yaakov Ettlinger, Ben-Zion Ettlinger is the one who added that line, Sakim lahalacha v'lo lemaaseh. So as far as his father is concerned, there is no proof whatsoever that he didn't want us to learn from this, that he didn't want us to actually gain here a principle that could be applied more expansively. So Rabbi Ettlinger is asked, what about the wine of non-observant Jews? We have these psakim, we have in the Beit Yosef, we have all these different tshuvas that say you can't drink the wine. What do we do today where most of the Jews are non-observant? What do we do the day when our relatives, when our friends, you know, we get invited over, we can't eat their food, can't we at least drink wine, make a l'chaim, whatever, you know, a l'chaim on wine, you know, whiskey is a different story. And Rabbi Ettlinger writes something very sensitive, but I think it navigates in a very, very nuanced way this whole issue, and I'd like to look at it with you. He says, first, before we actually read the text, he says, of course we know you can't drink the wine of a Mechalel Shabbat before Hesia. Why? Because a person who desecrates the Sabbath publicly, as the Midrash tells us and as Rashi brings down, is declaring their lack of belief in Ma'aseh Bereshit, in creation. Because Sabbath is a day when we declare our belief in creation of the world in 6-7 days. And that's why a public Sabbath desecrator is kigoy l'chol davar, or ki'ilu oved avodah zara, like an idolater. And then he goes on, however, as to the sinners of Israel of our time, I do not know how to consider them. For because of the multitude of our sins, the sore has spread widely to such an extent that for most of them, the desecration of the Sabbath has become like a permissible act. People don't, you know, go out and say, I don't believe in this anymore. They just, this is how they're brought up. This is what people do. He's describing the modern condition. There are those among them who offer Sabbath prayers and sanctify the day through the Kiddush on the wine and then violate the Sabbath both regarding biblical and rabbinical prohibitions. The Sabbath test creator is considered an apostate only because by denying the Sabbath, he denies the creation of the creator. But this man acknowledges them by his prayer and kiddush. And just how many of you know people, or maybe people, or grew up in homes where, whether it was right or wrong for economic reasons, parents had a store, it was a winter Shabbos, they didn't feel that they could close the store or the business, so instead of coming home at 4 o'clock on a winter Friday, they came home at 6 o'clock, but the table was set. And they washed up quickly, and the children were ready, and as soon as they were able to, the father would get up, and he would take the Kiddush cup, and he would say, Vayera vayivoke, Yom HaShishi vayichulu HaShamayim v'aretz v'chol tzva'am, and he would declare before his family his absolute belief in the creation, in God's creation of the world. So Jacob Ettlinger says, can we compare that person to the classical image of the public Sabbath desecrator as the person who is destroying Jewish tradition and is an apikoros, is a heretic? That's one category. But you see already he's looking for a leniency. And he says, what about these people's children who didn't get a Jewish education? What about them? B. And certainly their sons who arise in their places who neither know nor have heard Sabbath ordinances are similar to Sadducees or act according to the ways of their parents, and they are like an infant taken captive among the idolaters, and it is possible that Sadducees too were not used to being among Israel, etc. Here, this is the line that everyone knows. Even those, or especially those who didn't get a Jewish education, they can't be compared to the classical pre-modern public Sabbath desecrator. You know why? Because the Gemara and Shabbos at the beginning of the seventh parak, it talks about a tinok shenishba, about an infant who has been kidnapped at the youngest of ages and brought up. Think about the Holocaust, people who were brought up in convents, monasteries, etc. Can you blame that person if at the age of 13 or 14 they don't know what Shabbos is? A person who doesn't know what Shabbos is can't be responsible for not keeping Shabbos. Well, this is really, really dramatic. This is really, really revolutionary. Because Rabbi Ettlinger, in a de facto way, it's not a code, it's a legal decision. Rabbi Ettlinger has basically said that most modern Jews are no longer halachically mechalei Shabbat b'parhesia, even if, in practical terms, they're doing exactly the same things as the people did 200 years before and were put in chayrim for it, or were threatened with chayrim for it. Because the big factor is knowledge and education. If you lack education, you are not responsible for your actions. And I'll just point out that once this principle was set in play, others took it another step. Rabbi Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook said that even a person who was born into a frum home and saw halachic practice day in, day out throughout their childhood and young adulthood, if that person in the early 20th century leaves tradition and no longer keeps the laws, that person is not responsible, because modernity, modern society, is so powerful that he describes it in sexual terms as being something that's so enticing that most people cannot control the allure, of the world and of shedding the yoke of the mitzvot. Now, again, this is very famous. A lot of people are familiar with this, and for people who are looking for ways to create bridges of dialogue and to maintain a level of social plurality between Jews of multiple persuasions in terms of their religious observance, well, Jacob Ettlinger is like the champion. People love to declare Tinok Shenishba solves everything. That's how I heard about this tshuva. I'm not trying to burst the bubble, But I think that if we look a little further, we'll see that Rabbi Ettlinger didn't say quite that. He did say that, but he said a little bit more, and I think what he says that people don't read, because everyone stops reading the Teshuvah here, is in a way more instructive in terms of understanding that issue of our self-definition than the part that we read till now. Let's turn the page for a second and look at a short quote by Mary Douglas. Mary Douglas is an anthropologist, a British anthropologist, who's written a lot of interesting works about issues of purity and impurity in primitive societies or non-Western societies and in Western society. And she creates two categories that I found very instructive. One of them you heard about from Professor Heilman previously. She talks about the difference between a hierarchy and an enclave. Hierarchy is essentially based on grading, so it must tolerate the idea of a recognized bottom level and make provision for it. Who are enclavists? We'll get to the hierarchists in a minute. But let's look at enclavists and tell me who's an enclavist between Rabbi Sofer and Rabbi Ettlinger. Enclavists have reasons to avoid grading their members altogether. Their habit is outcasting rather than downgrading. Their exclusions all work on the outer boundary, the difference between belonging and not belonging. So who is an enclavist among the two that we read? The Chatam Sofer. He's an outcaster. His belief, he's an enclavist. His belief is the only way to preserve Judaism in the modern world is to say either you're in or you're out. And if you're out, he goes to the extreme of saying, you can't even marry, even if you're halachic Jews in every way. That is an enclavist position, and it's one which is adopted on various levels by groups among Jews. But I would argue that actually, most Jews are not, and even the more ultra-Orthodox groups today, are not enclavists, but they sit on a range within what I would call hierarchy or being hierarchists. What are hierarchists? Well, we know the term hierarchy. Hierarchy doesn't work on in, out, or in, out. Hierarchy works on rivadim, levels, gradations. And it says that there's a big umbrella, there's a pyramid. And there's a pinnacle to that pyramid, and there are lower levels. All people, or almost all people, can in one shape or form be covered by that umbrella, be included in that framework. However, there are grades. And this is my analysis. I'm not telling you if it's good or bad. Everyone will judge here. I think that we're all capable of that. But in the hierarchical formation of things, there are grade A Jews, and there are grade B Jews, and there are grade C Jews. They're all Jews. But rather than creating in-out boundaries, what we do is what we create is internal boundaries that allow us to say, you're a Jew, but you're not as good a Jew. Now, we'll talk about that a little bit more, but now look at Rabbi Ettlinger. Look what he says at the end of his teshuva, after he gave this unbelievably revolutionary heter, leniency, regarding the modern Sabbath desecrator. He says the following, see, therefore, in conclusion, in my humble opinion, I added the numbers to make it easier for us. One who acts strictly and considers wine touched by these evildoers, poshim, to be plain, forbidden wine, stam yenan, meaning aser wine, forbidden wine, a blessing shall come to him, tavo alehem bracha. Well, if they're tinok shenishba, if they're infants taken captive, and they're not responsible for their actions, why would you want to be so pejorative and call them poshim? It says, Uposhin yekashlubam, the Navi Hosea says. I think it's Hosea. Poshim. Well, Rav Cheska Landau said Chassidim instead of Poshim, but he changed it. But Hoshea said, Uposhim yikashlumam. A Poshea is a criminal. He's a bad person. Now, if you're trying to be pluralistic and you're trying to say we're all Jews, we all go together, why are you calling them Poshim? Well, I think the reason is because Rabbi Ettlinger is trying to do something that we all, many Orthodox Jews, try to do, which is juggle or live on that border between arevut, responsibility, or rather than responsibility, brotherhood. We're in the brotherhood hall right here, or sisterhood. The sense of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh is that we are all one nation, we are all one family, one tribe. But he also has a religious ideal. He is also a member of what I would call a community of the faithful. He believes that Orthodoxy is true Judaism. He doesn't believe that people who are Mechalel Shabbat are doing the right thing. And he is the head of a community. He's got a big problem, because if he says everyone takes their path and they are all on equal level, well, what are you going to teach your children? What are you going to tell your children? Well, we're all the same, but we think the right way is this. Well, the truth is, as many of us know, probably most of the children will stay with the path anyway, because social issues often contribute much more than theological issues to how a person decides to establish their own home in adulthood. They want to be with the people who are like them. But leaving that aside, particularly during a moral panic, particularly during periods in which Orthodoxy is under attack, and someone might claim that the modern period is a constant moral panic, a constant framework of boundary crisis. So in that such a situation, Rabbi Ettlinger says, if I say they're just Tinok Shenishba, then why would an intelligent young man or woman not come to me and say, well, so their path is equal to my path. And a Reform Jew is also a Tinok Shenishba, because if you brought up in a Reform home, why are you any... So that there goes Rav the Chatam Sofer's thing too. So I think that Rabbi Ettlinger creates a model which is complex, but it's done in order to navigate a tension. After he goes through that ideal, the ideal Orthodox Jew is the Jew that stays among Orthodox Jews, is the Jew that maintains a sense of Elyonut, of above. Well, of course, yet also the leaning ones have on what to depend. It's not like if you drink their wine, you're terrible. I gave you a heter. But he doesn't say tavoleh ambracha. He doesn't say it's good. He doesn't say it's ideal behavior. He's not trying to encourage a pluralistic type of communal environment. He is trying to find a way for families not to be torn apart. He's trying to find a way for certain social bonds to remain, to maintain a sense of we are a people, but again, without compromising his commitment to an ideal. There is one exception where he says there are those people who commit these transgressions on a regular basis in public, who in certain situations, he says, those people, I can't even drink their wine. It's almost absolutely clear to me that he's talking about a Reform rabbi who grew up in an Orthodox home and not only doesn't keep the law, but actually tries to encourage other people to not keep the law. So what I argue in this book, and I think that this is my general perception of the roots of a condition, is that this is the hierarchical position is the one which for the most part has been adopted by the range of Orthodox groups and authorities throughout the modern period as they entered societies in which there was no longer a plurality of observant Jews. In Eastern Europe, it's a little different. But as we look at, if we look at American Orthodoxy for that matter, I think that the hierarchical framework is very alive and well. I think that in Israel we see it in all sorts of interesting forms. And what one of the things that I didn't really expand upon is that there are also sort of ways that we do it with, I would call it internal symbols. Like here, I'll give you three examples, real quick ones. Have you ever gone to a mashkiach and said, I see you give a hechsher on that restaurant. What do you hold in that restaurant? They said, you know, we give a hechsher because there's Jews who go there. So, but yeah, if you're a frum Jew, pasnish, I wouldn't go there. That's hierarchy. Rav David Zvi Hoffman has a tshuva where he talks exactly about that, where he says, do that. He says, you shouldn't go to that restaurant. Other people, it's better than going to a treif restaurant. Here's one, I don't know if you have this in America, but certainly in Israel. In Israel, you go to a lot of weddings, and the waiters and waitresses are Jews, but they're non-observant Jews. Here, we're talking about wine. And so many times I've sat at a wedding, and there's been a bottle of wine on the table, and you go to the waiter and you say, could you open that wine? And they say, just a minute, I'll bring the mashkiach over. Now, I don't expect the waiter or the waitress to know the tshuva of Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. But obviously the mashkiach knows it, and he tells the waiters, b'chol zot, I should open the wine. That's a boundary marker. That's a way, an internal language. That's a way to maintain internal boundaries without cutting off. Another one, which is, I imagine it exists in many communities in America. I know it exists in Israel. It's also like sort of a quiet thing. In Israel, most Jews are buried in public cemeteries. It's one of the rites, you know, one of the things people don't talk about. You know, people talk about when you make aliyah, you get a tax break on a car, you get a good mortgage, you get, you know, upan. You also get free burial in Eretz Yisrael. You know, for some people that's a valuable commodity. Anyway, but you might not know that in most cemeteries in Israel there's a frum section and a non-frum section. And that is, in a sense, what I might call an eternal boundary that seems to make this hierarchical framework something which is lanetzach forever. I'm going to end not exactly with a question, but maybe with a thought, and I don't have solutions, but I think that this is something we have to be thinking about. Some Israeli authors, I mentioned Amos Oz last night, and I'll mention him again. He says something interesting. He says, you know what? In a book called Po Vesham Be'Eretz Yisrael, he says, you know what? These modern Orthodox, open-minded, Rav Kook type people who try to tolerate us and find all these gymnastics within the halakha to sort of understand us and find a way to, you know, I understand where they're at, but on the other hand, there's something really, really paternalistic about this whole thing. You know, I'm not a tinok. I'm not a baby. I'm an intelligent human being who has drawn certain conclusions based on my own life experience and my own intellectual training. You find a way to interface with me by referring to me as an infant taken captive? That's really, you know, on the border of insulting. I'd rather you call me an apikoros. I'd rather you tell me you don't want to drink my wine. I'd rather you tell me that I'm like a goy. But at least be honest with me and take me for what I am and address me in an honest, direct, face-to-face way rather than creating these types of complex, blurred, hedged types of paternalistic terminology and categories. I think that is a great challenge for us. And when I say us here, I do mean people who are not interested purely in convincing non-observant Jews to become Orthodox, but in Jews who are committed to Orthodoxy are more than happy to show those who are interested in expanding their knowledge and observance what their perception of Torah and mitzvot is about, but also have deep respect for Jews who are different and consider a partnership with them to be of value for the future of Klal Yisrael. I think that the challenge of creating a viable new type of relationship, which is non-paternalistic, but at the same time continues to allow Orthodox people to be passionate about their beliefs and their commitments, I think that is a great challenge that stands before us, and I hope that we'll be up to that challenge. Thank you very much.